The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Friends, welcome once again to my program, and I have on the line with me someone that I've not had the privilege to meet face to face, but I can tell just from talking to him, the people that he knows, the people to whom he is related. You're going to love this time with Dr. Paul Cannings. He is the senior pastor of Living Word Fellowship Church in Houston, Texas. He is on the radio there in Houston, also on television in Houston as well. And he happens to be the brother-in-law to someone we all know and love, and that is Dr. Tony Evans. So Dr. Paul Cannings, thank you for being on my program. Welcome to Afternoons with Mike.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Mike. Thanks for allowing me the opportunity.
So I heard about you through Ryan Noble, who was on my program about a month ago now. Ryan is such a great guy, was part of the team, still is part of Dr. Tony Evans' team. And that's how I met Ryan in February at the NRB. And as I mentioned, you're related to Dr. Evans yourself. Your sister was his wife, who passed away at the end of last year, I believe it was. And on behalf of all of us that know Tony Evans and love him and felt the pain of his loss, which is now also something that we can express to you, how sorry we are for your loss and the loss to your family.
Oh, man, Mike, we appreciate it. This was a very difficult time. Sister was always so healthy and so, you know, vigilant in times of taking care of her health and just, you know, always have a lot of energy and stuff. So we, as a family, we are surprised that she's the one to pass away, to be honest with you. So it's difficult because of the impact that she's had in everyone's life.
I can tell that she was so loved. The funeral that I was able to watch a good portion of was exemplary in terms of just how many people loved her so deeply. And that was an amazing tribute that was given to her on that day. And so, Dr. Paul Cannings, thank you for your role in all that you have done together with her for the glory of God. And it's just so clear to see that you guys have a family that loves the Lord.
Thank God for the heritage, you know, that our parents brought up, Mike. You know, we just had really good parents, you know. We just thank God for them. My mom was a homemaker. So my dad, very involved in his family. We were eight of us. And my mom was a homemaker. And so she really taught us to love the Lord. Not just to know his word, but to love him. And that's as a result of loving him, we want to do his word. So I always say that my mom, even though my dad was there, we had devotions together as a family every Sunday morning. My mom was the best teacher I've ever had, no matter how much education I've gained through my life. She just has been that impact in all of our lives. So I'm not surprised that Lois did all she did with the passion that she had and the drive that she had, because we always thought we grew up with ministry as something you do. That's something you decide to do. It just was a natural part of our family.
You know, there's so many times we see families like this and hear reports where it is just so clear the impact of the example of a mom or a dad has upon the children. It's really difficult to describe what a role that is in shaping not only the character and the helping form the personality of that child, but also pointing them in their future role in life. And that's exactly what happened with both of you. You and Lois were just almost like set on a direction for ministry, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually, it's you can find that throughout our family. You know, my brother has an after-school program for kids that are failing. in school and he gets those kids, he jumps on a bus after working the 11 to 7 shift, takes a couple of few hours sleep, and he goes out, makes sure everything is ready during the day, goes out and service those kids and get them back in the school and I get them focused. And then if they do well, he will help them set up their lives by getting them a car to go get a job and go to school if they qualify to the qualifications he has. My sister is in England, traveling. She lives in England. She travels all over Europe speaking. My sister right above me, she works for Dr. Evans, been his children's director for 30 years, retired, trying to take care of our parents when they got older, and she retired to be the caregiver because I'm in Houston. Our family spread out all over the place. But she now is working with Dr. Evans again because she worked also in his fulfillment department. And now she's working as his personal assistant because she was around the family living in Houston. She's like a second mom to his kids. So she's now his personal assistant as he tries to keep up with this major vacuum that is left. So since my sister knows the ins and outs of what our sister did, she's able to help him. So our whole, our whole family, except for maybe a brother in Germany, because he served in the military for 24 years, and a brother that lived in New York, and a sister in Maryland. Outside of those three who do regular jobs, good people, everybody else is doing something. But that's just the impact my parents had. You know, they just, it wasn't like they beat us into the head to do it. It wasn't like they, you know, they forced us into anything. It's just what we did. I mean, just the example, a quick example is my mom finding out some people in the village in Guyana, South America. We lived in the city, but out in the countryside, didn't have anyone to play for them. And my mom would take that pump organ back in those days, put it in the back of my dad's car and drive way out there and play for those ladies and help them all the way through their particular function that they had. That's after making sure dinner was cooked, because I came home, you know, kids, we don't understand all the dynamics, but came home, dinner is ready, all of this stuff is done, and she's giving instructions to the older children, and she's gone and comes back home to make sure we go to bed and do our devotions. That's the kind of stuff I grew up around. So it's not what we do, is just what we do. It's something is abnormal.
And tell me again, where was that? Where was your home?
I grew up in Guyana, South America. That's before Jim Jones. He left a bad stain on our country.
But,
I grew up in Guyana, South America. I came to America at 15, again, because my mom found out that if we get all our, she's heavy on education. I mean, she just did. That's one thing she didn't play with at all. Now, that one was beaten into us if we weren't taking it seriously. But so she wanted all our kids to find out that if kids got educated in Guyana, then when they move to any place else, they have to start over just about. So she decided to come to America when Tony and Lois got married, and she stayed and got us our citizenships. I mean, our green cards and all that, and brought us all over here because she wanted us to all be educated. So that's how my sister ended up in England, because she sent her there for nursing. My mom was vigilant about my dad and mom. I don't know why I just said my mom. Dad was, you know, he didn't play when it come to education. So it was a no-brainer in our family. Study time was study time.
What a wonderful legacy you have, and it's great to know. And you have worked hard at your education, too. You've actually studied at Oxford in England.
Yes, I did some coursework there. It was always a dream coming from Guyana, being a British colony, to go to Oxford. And the program I got into in Dayton, Tennessee, allowed me the opportunity to go to Oxford because it was way too expensive to go for their entire program. So I was able to still go by connecting to that, to the school, an Oxford graduate school.
For somebody that wouldn't know about how that works, my son is looking at that very same thing. A person who is in a program in the States can do some coursework in England like that. And it gives a real experience, kind of tops off almost like the cherry on top, isn't it, for your studies and all of the opportunities, even if it's for a couple of weeks. That coursework done over there is probably never forgotten.
No, it's a different way of learning, a different style of learning. And I really admire their style of learning, especially at a PhD level. You know, they respect your research. If it's weak, then you go to classes for it. If it's strong, then you move on. So they kind of test you and allow you to branch out in areas of interest. So I like that. So that you're studying to your passion and your interests, and they nurture that in you. So that by the time you get out, now they take your research and use it for their books, but at least you're able to, you know, research and grow attached to your passions. And I like that.
Well, it's a wonderful experience, and I'm glad you got to do it, and I'm grateful for the opportunities and education that you have obviously excelled in. You know, up until a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Cannings, what was on the minds and hearts of so many people was this pandemic that we've all been facing and having to adjust our lives around that and how it has affected church life. Let's talk about that just for a second. We know what life is like in Florida, and on the news, Florida and Texas are almost always mentioned in the same breath as being states where things are opening back up again. How would you say things are looking right now in the Houston area for churches as they are coming back to opening their Sunday services back up for congregational meetings? How's that going?
It's going pretty good. You know, I got off the phone with the mayor about 2 days ago, and just trying to make sure that we do things. You know, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13 talks about, you know, the fact that we must, you know, respect governments and authority and stuff like that and how we function. So I checked in with him, and the report he gave me is that, you know, it's plateaued, and there are spikes from time to time because of, he doesn't know if it's because of the nursing homes or because of the parades that are taking place. But sometimes there's a spike, but it's not like it's spiking up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
For a city of roughly about 7 million people, we only have 131 deaths. And I don't say that callously. Compared to the number, there's 131 deaths there. Partly because Houston is not as concentrated as New York. It's spread out in many areas. Mm-hmm. So people, for the most part, obeyed staying at home orders. So that helped a lot in our city. So churches are coming back. We don't come back until the 21st, which is Father's Day. And the governor has allowed us to come back at our own discretion. But he wants all of the social distancing rules to be followed. And we're going to definitely do that as a church. And many churches are seeking to do that. You know, the CDC has put out recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
And our staff has printed all of that out. And our maintenance staff is trying to make sure it's all done. So a lot of pastors that I'm talking to are being very vigilant about what they're doing based on those recommendations, because they don't want the church to have a stain that people came and got hurt. And then they don't want people to be hurt, period. And then they don't want the name of Christ to be thrown in with that. So they're really making absolutely sure that, that, you know, the name of Christ is good, and that the people coming that want to come, especially many of our seniors, are saying, I'm tired of home. I want to come.
Mm-hmm.
So that really concerns a lot of my friends, and they're doing everything they can to protect them.
You mentioned the seniors. Are you seeing in Houston some of the, let's say, adverse effects of being so quarantined as what we've been? There are so many doctors who are coming out and saying that there is like a potential tidal wave of new problems as people have been separated, not getting some of the medical care that has been deemed urgent, but it's still important. Are you seeing those kinds of impacts there in Houston?
Yeah, I mean, it's seniors, the seniors that, you know, I thank God for more. We have a person on staff that just calls them and prays with them and talks with them. But, you know, they're most of the people that are anxious to come out are the seniors, actually. It's interesting. The young adults are going, I don't know where I'm going. But the seniors are the ones that are going, I'm ready to come back to church, Pastor Cannings. What are we doing? So I could tell that they're tired of being at home. They're tired of not being able to hug their grandkids. That's been traumatic for them. Mm-hmm. Many of our seniors are just really hurting over that. I can't hug my grandkids. I can't be around my grandkids. And also the fact that their kids are having to come leave medication at the door. And they can't touch their kids, be around their kids. And then they have to wipe down everything and all this stuff. And then some of them, they need their kids in the house physically because of some of the ailments that they have.
Sure.
But some of the kids that I know at our church are going, I'm not going in there. Because if I hurt my nose, so they're struggling. So that the tension of that is becoming an epidemic because it's a struggle. A major struggle, even funerals that are taking place, is creating complications. And so that's why I've shared with all of them through social media and phone messages and stuff that, you know, we have to balance our view on this, even though we have to be careful and we have to respect the authorities. But how we respect the authorities has to do with the Word of God. Because at the end of the day, the person who protects us is the word, is God. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell them in 2 Chronicles 16, verse 11 through 14, he says he got mad at Asa because Asa was so depending on the doctors and not him that he allowed Asa to die. So we have to look at all that we are doing from a biblical perspective because that's our protection. And so that's why we're trying to follow all the CDC rules and all of that is because he's telling us to, not because they protect us. And so in teaching them that, I think it's kind of liberated some of their children, et cetera, to say, hey, I'm going to go in, I'm going to put on gloves, I'm not going to stay long. And that has helped our seniors, at least at our church.
Well, I'm sure that those seniors who are getting to come back, they're really looking forward to that Father's Day, first day back. And I think that's going to just do a lot of hearts really great to be back together and be able to worship together. And as much as possible, finding that new sense of normal that is going to be coming back.
Yeah, I really think so. And it's like one person say that they're glad we have a date. But to just endlessly go on is a struggle for them. So we're glad that people are wanting to come back. We know they're going to be afraid. So the fear is still there. So we'll work at that and how when they come back, they see how serious we are and how we will manage what we're dealing with. And hopefully that will reduce their fears.
I am sure that's going to help. I'm talking to Dr. Paul Cannings from Houston, Texas. He's my guest today on Afternoons with Mike, and we'll be back with him in a moment. Don't go away. This is the Shepherd Radio Network. On the line today with Dr. Paul Cannings. He is the pastor of Living Word Fellowship Church. They also have a Christian school there, I understand. And it's so great to talk to you and to hear a little bit of your background, to realize that you were Lois's brother, and that would be Lois Evans, the wife of Dr. Tony Evans. And you guys grew up in South America, Guyana, and boy, oh boy, so glad to have you in the United States. The impact that you are all making for the glory of God is significant. And you too, like Dr. Evans, you're in broadcasting. You have a radio show in Houston. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, by God's grace, we are on KHCB every day, 5:15 in the morning. He's blessed us to be on television in Houston and NRB and paulcannings.tv. And now we're going to be in the Caribbean on daily, and we're Trans World in Africa because we do mission work in Africa and the Caribbean, train pastors and leaders around the world, in various parts of the world, rather, not all over the world. So we'll be starting that pretty soon, and we have 2-minute programs on Moody. So our purpose for our radio program and television ministry is to. Years ago, I was a probation officer, juvenile probation officer, and I realized that people in the urban community, they don't have the backup systems that the suburban community had. And my boss moved me from the suburbs to the urban community because my recidivism rates were really low. And when I got in there, God exposed my eyes to the fact that They don't have the support mechanism. That time there was a raffle and all that kind of stuff. When a kid go left on their parents, because not every child, every community that is the hood, as we would call it, has all the kids bad. You know, there's just some people can't afford to live anywhere else. And I started reaching out to pastors, you know, being a seminary student that was attending Dallas Seminary at the time. I decided to reach out to some of the pastors and see if we could create some support mechanisms and realize that, you know, started learning that Dallas Seminary didn't accept African-Americans until the late 60s or early 70s. And these guys wanted to go to school, but they didn't have a lot of stuff available to them. And I started realizing I can graduate and I could just, you know, move off and get a job as a pastor and do what we do. But God put it on my heart to reach back to those type of pastors. So that's why Power Walk is around. Power Walk is around. We do media and all that, but it's to expose what we do training wise to minister to pastors and in smaller churches, pastors that probably can't afford to bring in a guy with my education and stuff. I just say no, but those guys need the word like anybody else, and they want the word to get to their people like anybody else. So we do this along with this whole team of us. I've interacted with other pastors who have the same heart that are well-trained, and we do stuff at Sedang Bible Camp where we invite pastors in, but our radio television ministry is an avenue to teach the word of God. Our passion is to teach the word of God so people can hear it sound, but they can apply it immediately. So that's why it's called Power Walk. It's you want to empower their walk for a daily walk with God. And when we do that, then we expose people, and then the pastors and leaders come, and we could train them and then immediately be able to impact the urban community through them. And that's, so it was born actually from me sitting on what they call the stoop in the hood, and seeing a young girl that was being abused by her grandmother, by just a lot of different things that was happening there that just totally tore my heart apart. And I said, man, I just can't graduate from seminary and go do the normal thing. I have to do something. And that's, if I felt based on the word of God, that if I impact the church, and since Christ, Ephesians 1, 22, 23, will work through the church to the world, to the community and the world. If I touch the church, then I'll touch the community and then I'll touch the world. And that's why we get on radio and television, all that.
You're seeing technology change right along with all the rest of us. There was a day that somebody like yourself with such a ministry could only rely on terrestrial radio or TV channels. But now with the internet, there is a wonderful marriage between all of these technologies. And you're seeing Power Walk do that as well. Give us that website, if you will.
Website. Oh, yeah, sure. Power Walk website is Power Walk Ministries, plural, powerwalkministries.org. PaulCannings.tv is another way to do it. And we are on oneplace.com. And that way people can just get on their phones or get on their laptops or when they take their lunch break and hear a message prayfully from the Lord.
So oneplace.com, explain that for our listeners who might not be familiar with that.
Sure. They type in oneplace.com in their search column and it pops up. And then, there are so many speakers on there, great speakers on there. And they, for Power Walk, they just have to search for Power Walk Ministries in the search column. We will pop up. Mm-hmm. And they hit the button and they immediately go straight to our webpage. And they can hear a series of messages that are on there.
Oh, that's wonderful. And thank you for providing that. Thank you for living a life, my friend, that obviously people are benefiting from your experience and are growing as a result of the teaching that you're doing. I so appreciate that. We've all been, using your terminology, had our hearts just ripped wide open the last couple of weeks. And I would love your thoughts on what you see happening and how is the whole Houston area being affected from the goings-on that started on that very sad day in Minneapolis with George Floyd and his death. Tell us what is happening there in Houston and what your thoughts are on what has gone on.
It's traumatic for me on a personal level. And and looking at the pain and eyes of people, some people that I talk to just can't finish without crying. I think it's, I remember when I was a 19-year-old kid in college, I was working the summer before three jobs to get back into school. And somebody came and said, hey, you could sell encyclopedias and make a lot of money. So I jumped into that. And I remember going through this with a police officer. I did everything I was supposed to do on all my training. But I went up to Muskie, Texas, is where he dropped us off along with a trainee because I was doing pretty good. So he gave me a trainee that day. I walked along the streets there and I started being called the N-word. I said, okay, you know, there may be just some tough kids in the neighborhood here. So I kept going. I had to do my job. That's just why I was raised. Go to work and work hard. And all that stuff was not beat into me physically, but just put into my mind as I grew up. So I persisted forward and I knocked on the door. I made sure I gave the distance away from the door, had a badge around my neck, all of this stuff. Next thing I know, there's a cop car screaming up to the side of the sidewalk. I'm being demanded to come to the back of the car. I'm handcuffed, put in jail, and I hadn't done anything. And I wasn't allowed to say anything. So I understand how powerless people feel. You cannot say anything to the police officer or you're immediately in all kinds of categories. You obviously can't touch the officer, even if your finger touched them. You have to be so careful not to do anything. You get in the back of the car, he is like he has a trophy. I mean, he's moving around in the community and the word is spreading that he caught whatever, but the N-word was being used so blatantly. And then he took us to the station and put us in the jail cell. It wasn't for my father coming in there. I thought my dad was going to be locked up in jail with me because he was loud. I could hear him from the back. But he just got me out of there. And thank God for my dad. You know, I called him and he said, I'm on my way. He never asked me what happened or nothing. He just said, I'm on my way. And he came down there and fought. I don't know what he said. I could just hear his voice. And I was out of there. Obviously, he looked at me and I knew what that meant. I had to resign that position. So I understand that, you know, the pain they feel. I got up the next day. I was angry and I couldn't do anything with that anger because you're powerless. You have no power. You can't do anything. This person has complete control over you and they can put crime to you. My life could have been finished. But whatever crime, if my dad didn't show up so quickly, my life could have been finished with false accusations, or I'll have a felon, which means I now can't get an apartment. I can't do nothing. I'll probably be kicked out of school because I'm this black person with a felony on me. So cops have done a lot for a long time, but I keep telling the congregation that there's a minority of cops, not the majority of cops. And I hate using the word cops, police officers, because there are officers out there. And based on the word of God, God set them up to protect us. That's what the Bible teaches. Mm-hmm. So as a police officers, there's many of them. And that's the only thing that I always say as I explain this. There are many police officers that I've met when I was a juvenile probation officer that want to do a good job, that want to protect people from evil. But there's some officers out there that have joined. I mean, I saw it on 60 Minutes where the guy said he was over the Ku Klux Klan. He said, instead of wearing white hoods, we decided to send people in to be judges and police officers and government. That way we could do what we want to do. He said it right on 60 Minutes. So those officers are out there that do this. They stop you. They ask you where you're going, why you're in this neighborhood. And you have no power. I saw them. Stop my son. My son is blowing me up on my phone and wondering why is my son calling me that many times? Because I always would tell them, if you call me and I don't pick up right away, I promise you within 5 minutes I'll get to you. But he kept calling and I picked it up and he said, Dad, there's four cop cars around me. And all I made was a bad turn. I'm sorry. I made a bad turn. And so I had to beg the police officer to take the phone and I begged him so that my son don't panic and do something wrong and get killed. That's how we think as African-Americans. I can remember going out to buy a car for my son, my first car. My wife says, we're not buying that one. They're going to think he is a gang person. And we think like that. We have to train our kids how to take a police stop and how to handle that stop. For those bad cops that are, both police officers that are out there, we live in fear of them. And so the anger I see, I don't agree with all the violence. I totally disagree with that. You know, the Bible says clear, you do not respond to evil with evil. You just don't. So, and you lose respect in the process. But the anger I see in them, and I saw in my son the next day, it led me to go to the police chief in the community there that we lived in and sat down with him and said, sir, I promise you that the kids I have will never be a problem to you. So, and officers were walking by me looking at the police chief as if, do we get him? I mean, it was a tense situation, even though we just went. We had an appointment. We sat in there. We asked questions. I was not disrespectful. My voice wasn't raised, but immediately you saw the officers moving like they're about to get us. I was followed in that community ridiculously to the point that I brought that up when I met with the chief. And that led to a better relationship because he wasn't a bad guy. I'm just saying this stuff exists for African-Americans and Hispanics. Hispanics are sometimes stopped just because they're thinking they're illegal. And so they're harassed. And so when I see what is going on out there, I feel them. I'm being honest with you. I'd rather not just say, I'm telling you from my own experience that it is painful. You have no power and you have no place to vent your anger. And that's why I see the anger. But the violence shouldn't be done. But this happens in the United States of America. And many African-Americans, especially in smaller cities, really live conscious when they see a cop different than a person that is Caucasian that sees a cop drive by. They live different. Now, there's a group of African-Americans that have now become affluent and all of those type of things, and they have connections in government and all that, and they may not feel it the same way. Mm-hmm. But the average African-American that is out there lives with that kind of intrepidation when they see a police officer.
If this moment that we've just had with you sharing so eloquently about the fear that these are living under, that are only guilty because they're African American, you were only put in up against that jail, or rather up against that police car because of your race. When something like this happens, and it seems like this discussion that needs to be had, this level of, and I believe right now, if there's something good that could come from all of this, I'm praying that people pause and separate out the wrong responses. I love the way you did that. We're not for violence. We're not for riots. We're not for looting and all of that. But somehow it seems that what has repeatedly happened, and you tell me if you agree with this, when there is something so terribly wrong, and maybe it has happened in this area or that area, it seems that that depth of wrongness is somehow kind of like thrown to the side because of the other things that start happening right off to the side, and that becomes a distraction to the real issue. Would you agree with that? Would you agree that at times that it seems that the real root need is lost because something else starts being discussed instead, and in this case, the riots and the violence?
Yeah, I sometimes I must admit the major networks will go straight to the riots, and there were so many peaceful marches across our city in Houston. A lot of peaceful marches were taking place. Nobody was doing anything, but the cameras go to the riots, and I totally disagree with the riots. I mean, when I use the word total, it's double on the line. It distracts. It just fuels that we are angry people and criminals. It just fuels all of those thoughts, and it hurts because most, I would say as many as 98% of the African-Americans out there don't agree with none of it. I mean, mm-hmm. They're in my office. They're frustrated that they're doing that because it distracts from the point we need to make that needs to be systemic changes, that whether it's judges. I've had a manual on my desk properly researched by a person that does statistics and all of that African-Americans are placed in jail on Hispanics for the same criminal background or no criminal background that the white counterpart face in jail longer, meaning longer than a white counterpart. So then they would say, well, look at you, most of you are in jail. And we're going, yeah, because this is what you do. And you're not willing to look at that. So the conversations like that are lost because of what is taking place with the riots. And when the riots are done, then we solve the problem. And so we're back to solving this criminal problem rather than solving the issue that is systemic.
Yeah,
that's why many of us struggle with these riots.
That was the point of my thought and my question to see. It seems that we just move on, and there's a lot of people, I think, that would just like to dust all of this under the carpet and act like everything is now taken care of because the violence, the riots are over. But what is not being taken care of would be this, what you're calling this systemic issue and it's not just there for no reason, is it? There is fear that is there for a reason. And that's what's got to be uncovered. If you had an opportunity, let me ask you a question like this. If you had an opportunity to address all of the police chiefs in the United States in a single meeting, what appeal would you make to them?
I would say to them that what Martin Luther King said, these words were to me eloquently nails it. Judge a person for their character, not for their skin. So when you see somebody, judge them as an American. Judge them as a person who has all the rights and privileges that come with being an American. When you walk up to them as a person who is supposed to uphold the law, not violate the law, then uphold the law with that person as an American. Don't look at the color of their skin. Look at the fact that they're a citizen of America. They're here, they pay taxes, they operate within this country, and they should receive the respect of any other citizen is going to receive in any type of circumstances. They need to look at how they arrest someone. When they come to arrest somebody, then they need to look at the fact that, hey, this person, the tactics that the officer is using, if the person is aggressive, what tactics they need to use for that person to make sure the person's life is not endangered. Change some of those things. Look at some of the policies you have that protect officers when they do violate it. Have a respect for the fact that if they're wrong, the law is wrong for everybody. Mm-hmm. So if a police officer goes out there and he does something wrong, the law is the law. It doesn't matter if he's a police officer or a citizen, the law is the law. So how you arrest someone when they're aggressive, address that so that they're not abused or the police officer is done given the, because of the high level of accountability. Even if he thinks about doing something that's outside of your new arrest policies, then that police officer has to sit back and think, because you are holding that person accountable and you're willing to do that openly. You don't do it secretly. You do it openly. And when you do, the next thing I would say to them is, you know, do better screening. You know, there's some officers, like I said, with the guy on CNN. Track them, social media, track if they have any affiliations with any kind of Nazi movements or KKK movements or any of these type of things. And if they do, then vet them to not be in the police department to carry out their personal agendas. Mm-hmm. So vet these officers even more. Check them out. Get FBIs to go do background checks. Maybe they do this. This part I don't know. So they may already do this. But check out their social media accounts. Go ahead and start checking who they hang out with in college or wherever. And start seeing, do some more thorough research. I know there's a lot of police officers in the country, and there's only so many FBI agents out there. But maybe create another department in the police department that will vet these folks more meticulously, so there's no personal agendas when they jump into those squad cars and drive. That to me, and create a culture in the police department where this is just not tolerated. That culture, I've seen that culture needs to improve in the police department, because everybody wants to protect each other, because they're in a difficult and dangerous job. They are. You don't know when you walk into a home trying to solve a domestic violence, you become the enemy if you did something wrong. So they're in a difficult job. I totally, 100% support that. They are. But this camaraderie when somebody's doing wrong needs to stop. When somebody's wrong in their department, They can't hang. They need to hold their brother accountable, their sister accountable, because of what they go through. There's a brotherhood that develops. I understand that. I played sports. When you're out there and sweating blood every day, you develop a camaraderie. You develop a brotherhood, sisterhood in that process. Mm-hmm. So I understand that. But in the midst of it, there's still accountability. Mm-hmm. I would say that to them so that the culture changes. There's no tolerance for that.
That is such an excellent answer. And I pray that there were many people in our law enforcement agency who heard that. And may that heart, may that advice go forward. I have one more question for you along those lines, because I believe this is another area. Number one was imagining you could speak to the police chiefs across the country, and you've done that. Now, speak to the hearts of people who are not Black, who are not maybe even aware of the kind of scenario that you painted, that you've gone through personally. What advice would you give someone who watches this and says to themselves, oh, it can't really be that bad? What advice would you give to that person?
I immediately tell them, until you live in someone's skin, you don't know. It's like the friends I have that are Bible church guys that are pastors of, and we talk openly, just bluntly, because they don't have thin skin, you know? Mm-hmm. And I say to them, I don't know what it's like to be white, but I'll tell you that there's some privileges that you have that you don't even know you have, because the majority of people in this country are white, and you tend to hang around most of them. So there's levels of things that you have that you don't even realize is normal for you, that is not normal for me. It's like my son said, he's tired of coding. And I said, define that for me, because the young people got different words like we had when we were growing up. And he said, if I'm around a white person and I sound too Black, I'm automatically can be viewed as a thug. Mm. So I would then change how I talk around them so that they would see that I'm educated or whatever, and how I interact with them. Therefore, their level of respect grows so I could properly communicate with them. A white person doesn't have to code. They can walk into certain situations. They can walk into a store and they not followed. They can go into a restaurant and they be able to be seated and served in some restaurants faster. Mm-hmm. So I would say to them, you have to understand that the world is different for us. It's just different. And then not too long ago, a few years ago, when the professor's house was raided, and there's a big discussion with Obama and other people that is about this whole thing of how a cop would even come to his house, not even knowing he's a professor and all these different things. We are in a different world, and the two worlds don't always meet. And it doesn't. And I love what a friend of mine says. He says, Paul, your world, you've convinced me that your world and my world is different. But what I love about it, please remember this all the time, difference doesn't make us better than you are. And I've had to learn that differences doesn't make one person better and the other person bad. It's just different. Mm-hmm. And I think when they understand that it is just different, and we're not bad, worse for it because some kids listen to rap music and other kids listen to rock music. None of these things are different. When we look at that and see that the difference does not create a lower class and a middle class and all this other stuff, then I think they would understand that I need to listen. I need to respect this. I need to come to this person understanding that they may decode my words different. And so if they decode it different, I need to maybe hang around them just a little bit longer, mm-hmm. to make sure they really understand me, that I didn't mean anything racist about what I said. I don't need to be so thin-skinned. I don't need to come to a situation thinking that this is the last thing I say about that. And I used to push this with my friends all the time. Don't see me as a missionary work when you come to me. Mm-hmm. You degrade me. I'm not a missionary work. I may not have had the education you had because you're privileged, even when you don't think you are. Mm-hmm. You're privileged. I may not have had different things, but that's because the schools that some African Americans go to, they are placed in these communities. When the welfare system stuck them in those communities, they end up with school systems that may not have had the best teachers go to them, because sometimes the kids did do things that are bad and the teachers don't want to go down in those neighborhoods. That did happen. But at the same time, there are kids that come out from there because they have parents like me. mm-hmm. like I had. So you can't class everybody that way. So that when you come to me, it's almost like you're coming down to somebody rather than just speaking to another human being. Mm. So it's just when you do that, the person feels valued. And when they feel valued, then the respect level is there and we learn and grow together.
Well, I trust that everyone who has heard this realizes just how valuable what you've given us all. It really is. It's eye-opening, and I pray, more importantly, that it's heart-opening, that everyone who listens, that this message that you've given us this morning as we're recording this, would go out across the country. And I pray that it's repeated over and over and over again, that we do have a systemic issue that's got to be addressed. And it's going to take all of us opening our hearts, because I'm convinced, Dr. Cannings, that there is a lot of people who really are much more affected with this impact of racism than they believe they are. I think that is a fair statement, that there's a lot more of this prejudice toward thoughts and the terrible examples that we've all heard you share that you've had to go through, that your son has had to go through and endure. It happens much more regularly than what people want to admit or are maybe even willing to acknowledge. But we've got to see that this is a heart issue that has got to be addressed. And it's going to only happen as we open, as we, meaning our country, opens up our hearts before God and say, God, speak to me. What is inside of me? Is there anything unholy? Is there anything not right? And God is faithful, isn't he? He will speak to our hearts if we open up like that.
I believe that, Mike. I really believe that. And I say to my African brothers and sisters that, we need to not look at every white person as racist. You know, sometimes we come to the picture already thinking that something's going to be wrong. And we need to come as fellow brothers and sisters, especially us church people, because we're the salt and the light. The world needs to see us love one another.
Yes.
And that's a passion of mine, is that the church needs to stand up and be an example in this. And we need to stop saying this is a white church and that's a black church. It's a church where mostly blacks go to. And it's a church where mostly whites go to, or Hispanics go to, or Haitians go to. That's the church that it's in. But we're not let the adjective describe the nature of the church. So I just say, that even as African-Americans, we need to believe in the principles that God has taught. And the thing that grabs me the most is 1 John chapter 2, verse 9 and 10. If I hate my brother, and the word hate for us is, beating people up or whatever, but the word hate in the Bible just means the guy on the road to Jericho that went on the other side. He distanced himself from something. He did not reach out and help. He just separated himself. That's what the word actually means. If I hate my brother, I don't know Christ. Matthew 22, verse 36 through 40. To love the Lord all my heart and soul and mind is to immediately have what needs to take place inside of me to love my neighbor. Mm. So the person we hate is Christ. It's not my neighbor first. It's Christ first. And that to me is what drives me as a human being, is that the model of Christ should come out of me. Like Paul would say, I no longer live. It is Christ that lives in me. So I can love a Gentile. Jesus Christ can love a Samaritan woman. He can love anybody. Doesn't matter who they were. If they were a sinner, he can love them. Mm-hmm. Because that's the nature of Christ. Christ can be on the cross and love the thief who once mocked him. And that's, to me, is where we're missing. We keep looking at all these things outside of ourselves rather than the person that needs to grow inside of us. And that's Christ. Once he says, if I hate my brother, in that passage in 1 John, the person that I don't know is Christ, and I live in darkness. And that's the major issue for me when it comes to the church. Mm-hmm. For us to hate means that this person we worship, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Because he is love. And everyone who is born of God is born in love, because that is what he is. He's love. And this stuff is not of God. And brother, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you and your words. I think you've impacted us more than we can even imagine. And I just... I'm so thankful that this is going to not only be on the air today, but it's going to be available on our podcast page at theshepherdradio.com. If you've liked what you've heard, be sure and tell other people. And my guest, Dr. Paul Cannings, thank you for being with me here today. And I can only say, please, you have an open door invitation to come and be back on my program. And when you're in Orlando, I'd love for you to come up in the studios and be with me up here again. And just thank you so much for your wisdom. Thank you for your heart for God. Thank you for your love for your people. And I appreciate that about you, Dr. Cannings.
Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate you allowing me to be on the program and allow me to be candid on the program. I appreciate that. That was very kind and open of you. Well, and I thank the Lord for that.
Well, I pray that these words get heard by many, many people across every barrier, if you will. And I love that one point, and we'll close with this. I believe that the Lord is the Lord of the church. It's not just this church or that church, this color or that color. There is one church. We're called to be brothers and sisters. We are called to be unified. And I love you as a brother, and I'm glad I got to know you, even if it's over a virtual meeting like this. Thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it very much, man. I'm glad to get to know you as well. And the openness that you have, this is a harsh phone call, and the kindness you've shown, I so appreciate it. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Friends, thank you for being with me today here on The Shepherd. We'll see you next time on Afternoons with Mike.